Hello, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshimworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Today, we're continuing our investigation into the ways that AI is informing ecosystems across industry and society, and exploring how we design pathways to resilient futures. I'm Diane Finkhausen, founder and CEO of Shoshimworks, and today I'm joined by my co-host, James Villarubia.
Hi, Diane. Oh, great to be here again. For those in the audience, as Diane mentioned, James Villarubia, I'm a Presidential Innovation Fellow with NASA. And what I do with NASA is help our engineers and scientists integrate AI into their daily work. I come with a background in startups and government work, so really excited to have our chat today and sort of understand the emerging risks in this space that could impact a lot of the organizations that I currently work for or have worked for in the past. Back to you, Diane.
Excellent. Thanks, James. Super excited about this and very excited to welcome our guests today, Dee Degampoche and Marcello Salvati from Protect AI. And we'd love to have Dee and Marcello, you walk through a little bit of your background and your bio for our audience today. Over to you.
Yeah, thanks. I'm Dee, the president and co-founder of Protect AI. We have a very deep and broad experience in machine learning and artificial intelligence, coming from AWS, Intel, finance sectors, Microsoft. We have a whole deep background of engineers, founders, security specialists, and we really focus on building a safer AI-powered world. We think that you do that through the practice of what's called MLSecOps. And that fundamentally, very easily understood, is to be able to see, know, and manage everything that's happening around your AI environment inside of your enterprise. And with me today is my friend and colleague, Marcello Salavalli, who is one of the best threat researchers around and period, bar none of any domain, and especially in the emerging field of artificial intelligence and machine learning. Marcello?
Thanks, Dee. Yeah, my name is Marcello. I have a very heavy open source and offensive security background. I've been developing offensive security tooling for the past 10, over a decade at this point. Started up a while ago, and I pivoted over to start out with my domain knowledge is mostly related to Windows and the Microsoft ecosystem, but I pivoted over to AI and ML recently. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. We're really excited to learn a little bit about your work and share with our audience maybe some tools and tips to help them navigate this landscape a little bit more effectively. So maybe over to start with you, Dee, your team is leading a lot of important work that will benefit both industry and policymakers alike. You recently, your team was in to speak to a congressional testimony recently. You're helping organizations really, I think, take a more thoughtful inventory of the systems that they've deployed, the AI-enabled technologies that are resident in that landscape, and then take a really practical inventory of the risks to be managed. You mentioned the see, know, and manage framework and how that's helping to kind of shape a more practical approach for teams. You've also mentioned in our conversations the nuances between safe, secure, and govern. Can you maybe kind of walk us through those frameworks and how that starts to shape very kind of thoughtful inventories and practical mitigation strategies for the teams that you're working with?
Yeah, sure. I think the important thing is to start with that last point, right? We see a big difference between safe, secure, and governed, as you mentioned. Just because you are one doesn't mean that you're all three. And if you think about any dual use element, you can ensure that it is safe when it is consumed, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's secured when it's out. So whether it's a drug that is deemed safe by, say, the FDA, if that drug is a Schedule I pharmaceutical of some kind, if it's out on the table, that doesn't mean that it's secure. And there are around that are kind of a set of policies and laws and regulations, and that's kind of in the governed space, right? So we think of them as distinctly different things of safe, secure, and governed. But you can't be any of them if you can't contextualize it and make those things tangible. And the ability to make artificial intelligence tangible is not, hey, can I put in a cool prompt and have it give me a really funny response? Hey, tell me a joke and it comes back with some creative thing. It's really ensuring that in the artificial intelligence landscape, what was used to make that artificial intelligence thing, who necessarily was touching all the elements of that thing in its production and its development, when it was last changed or modified, who is now engaging with that thing, and is that thing, that AI thing, behaving as expected? And if not, do you have the ability to inspect? Why not? Right? So to achieve that, we start with this notion of you really need an AI, ML, AI or machine learning bill of materials, or AI ML bomb. That is the foundation. So if you want, I like to say, if you want a secure house of AI, you better start with a rock solid foundation of AI lineage and understanding how that works.
Yeah, I really like that idea of sort of lineage, because I think one of the things that I'm seeing, and for our audience, I'm sure they've sort of seen, even the non-technologists out there have seen this trend shift. The ecosystem has blown up recently with large language models, LLM, ChatGPT being the infamous one, so much so that ChatGPT is sort of synonymous with LLMs at this point. But the shift is, I think, from the old style of sort of organizations with lots of data building their own AI. I got the data, I train it, I get an output, I use it. It sort of gave them a lot more control. And now we've got this sort of new emerging ecosystem where I'm not going to spend the billions of dollars to train my own GPT. Seems sort of silly, but I am going to rent it. And I think the change that happened in 2023 is that those big models that were behind the walls at these big companies have now been are now rentable. They've opened them up. How does that sort of shift from building to sort of renting to not owning the full process to sort of relying on someone else's training data? I mean, how does that really shift sort of the ecosystem that we are seeing regarding security? Are we prepared for that? What are you seeing from your end?
So I think this technological transformation is following the arc of every other one prior to it, which is that developers ultimately want to be operating at the highest level of abstraction possible, right? When you couple that with the just expense, the both capital expense and the talent expense of being able to build your own model from scratch, like there's very few people that can do that, right? And there's even fewer companies who can afford that capability, both in terms of capital, i.e. salaries, and talent, i.e. who do I know? How do I even know who to hire? So what's really happened, though, is that it's not so much a buy versus rent mentality, right? It's more of adopt versus modify. So what do I mean by that? There's a big difference between saying, hey, I'm going to rely on a completely managed service vendor, a la OpenAI's service, if you will, and I'm just going to throw everything over there to that company and that organization. It takes a long time to build trust with enterprises, particularly regulated industries, and even more specifically governments. I mean, let's be clear, there are still enterprises who think that the cloud is not as safe as their own data center. Now, that is a completely false narrative. Right? That is like, it's nuts. If you think that you're a small enterprise today and you can outdo the security of the major cloud operators, good luck to you, right? And if you're a public company that thinks that, perhaps you should be prepared for a run on your stock, because it's not a matter of if you're going to get hit, it's when. So what I mean by that technological transition now is that essentially what's happened is, hey, it takes a long time to build trust in new vendors in this landscape, new partners that I can rely on. So instead, what I'm going to do is, rather than adopt that, I'm going to modify something that's already in the open source community, and I'm going to put it inside of my own trusted cloud architecture. And so you see this big dynamic playing out where I remember when GPT two, and one were being developed because we came from that world, right? We kind of saw this evolution. Then all of a sudden it was put into Chat GPT. It was basically an app of GPT. And everybody was like, oh, this is incredible. It's such a huge model, blah, blah, blah. Now it's like, big deal. It's 7 billion parameter model. I can download that tomorrow, run it on my laptop. It's kind of insane, right? So the thing about that is that people are adopting those open source capabilities. And that's really kind of where you start getting into trouble. Because essentially, when you have even somebody that you might not trust, if you're running it, at least you have the proverbial one throat to choke or one face to punch, if you will, when things go haywire. But when you're taking open source assets and you're doing two things, you're innovating super fast, really quickly, and you're delivering what you think is value is the first thing. The second thing you're doing is you're leaving a large set of gaps that you can drive trucks through in terms of security, safety, and increasingly governance, right? And so as that open source ecosystem just completely accelerates, there are open source models that will outperform all of the big service providers. It's a fraction of the cost. So they're going to take it down. They're going to make it applicable. It's better performance, lower cost, fully manageable. I can trust it in air quotes because it's inside of my system, even though you have no idea who was behind that, which goes back to the lineage around what is it? Where was it sourced? Who touched it last? Should it be allowed in this environment? Should it not be? All of those things happen. And as you get into open source of not only the models, but the way in which you're putting that model into production, you run into a lot of problems. And I think, Marcello, you're probably equipped to talk about kind of how we think about the open source gaps in those constructs. You have any thoughts there, being the lead security researcher in this space?
Yeah, I think from what my perspective and Dan's perspective, my colleague who works with me, the biggest thing that we're seeing is a lack of secure by design principles being applied to open source projects related to both ML and AI. And we're seeing sort of like a renaissance of all of these security problems that have essentially been solved for like a decade reemerge in these kind of open source software stacks. So there are a bunch of projects specifically that we've gotten multiple reports on that have like 30,000 stars on GitHub, which is extremely popular projects that are used industry wide. And they have vulnerabilities and weaknesses in them that you usually don't really see that often in modern web applications or modern applications anymore. So, but this is like one of those things where like history sort of repeats itself in a way where you see new technologies come out. And the sort of the lessons that we've learned over the past decade or 20 years or so of computer security have been completely forgotten. And we haven't really learned anything, it turns out. So we're seeing this cycle repeat itself for AI and ML applications specifically. And it's an interesting area to be in. It's also a very interesting, I guess, reemergence of these vulnerabilities.
We like to say it's old trick, new dog.
Mm. Yeah. I really like that framing of we've seen this before, because I certainly, and I suspect our audience has, I think that the narrative around the threat of AI is largely around killer robots emerging, which is just so absurd to the people in the industry. But it sounds like from what you guys are saying, the reality is it's here. It's a lot different than what you think it is, but it's actually pretty similar to what we've done before. So we have paths, we have sort of protocols and governance structures to use, but we've got to sort of adapt them to the AI. And that's what you guys are, that's the sort of niche, the sort of open space that you guys are solving for. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think history doesn't repeat, but it sure as hell rhymes. So in this case, what we're seeing is RCEs are not new, but if you're deploying LLM endpoints and all of a sudden you have a way to just pass code in the prompt so that it auto-generates an RCE or allows a remote shell to be automatically placed on that endpoint because you were stupid, frankly, around how you deployed your security on that endpoint, then it's like, whose fault is it? Is it the LLM model? No, it's yours because you didn't do what you should have done to begin with. Right? You just didn't think about it because everybody was going so fast.
I'd love to hear some of the examples. So you're seeing the good and the bad, right, in this landscape. Are there some examples of lineage and just great kind of well-informed practical applications and Are there sectors that are getting this right,
Yeah.
or are there groups that are more that are better at deploying what we've learned?
Yeah, so I think we have, being the broadest and deepest, most comprehensive platform for AI security, we see across a lot of industries, right? And what I would tell you is that the usual suspects of, hey, I'm going to try to figure out how to take this technology and create competitive advantages, it always tends to lead with the tech industry, quickly followed by finance. And then there's this long curve of adoption and everywhere else. What I think is more interesting about this is that pattern still holds. However, the bell curve of acceleration is really kind of being spiked in two areas. One actually is in healthcare, biotech, and life sciences. This was quite frankly a surprise to us, because if you would have asked me what is an industry that's adopting generative AI, which is a different type of class of artificial intelligence application, because the model itself is slightly different in terms of how it's used. If you were to ask me 2 years ago, what industry do you think is going to go the fastest? The industry I would not have said is biotechnology and life sciences. But as we have learned about that, what we are seeing is that there is tremendous amounts of adoption in that space, because it really fits the workflow of how people think about molecular development, right? That the genotype, those genes to phenotype process, or G2P processes, where you can insert generative AI capabilities throughout the research cycle and the research life cycle. And it really does make a huge difference. And you can go Google some headlines, but like in silico's drug discovery and kind of what a lot of other people are doing for protocol developments, et cetera. And that has a whole nother regulatory framework in and of itself. But to answer your question, Diane, I would say biotechnology is already thinking about lineage in a way that I don't think too many other industries are. That's because they're familiar with it, right? They're familiar with the need of like chain of custody. They're familiar with the need of secure supply chains. They're familiar with the need for labeling and safety requirements, because that's really what we're talking about, right? Like if you think about the FDA and how they invoke labeling as a key criteria for any consumer consumed food product, it's like, duh. You should probably do that with your AI models, right? Like start there. So I would say that biotech space, life sciences, ag, there, it's easy for them to understand why AI, ML, bill of materials, and thus lineage is so important and why it needs to be exposed.
I really like that example from the telehealth, and I think we talked about this before recording, and I want to make sure our audience gets the benefit of this. But you had this really great example, Dee, around sort of attestation and sort of the nature of this like changing control flow, this management flow, mm-hmm. where we think the abstraction that we are getting from AI is great, but in reality, there's a trade-off there around sort of trust that maybe we're not considering fully. And I just would love you to share that with the audience. And,
yeah.
Because you know, I found it very informative.
Yeah, sure. I mean, think about one of the things that with the COVID restrictions that came into play, one of the things that happened was telemedicine really kind of took off, right? This notion of like seeing your doctor virtually. So it accelerated that notion of, hey, what can I do digitally? And how can I use different mediums to see and engage with my healthcare professionals and my doctors? What's really interesting is that in most states, what happens is from the minute you make the request using an app for a telemedicine component, from that moment all the way through, let's say you're just diagnosed with a basic sinus infection, and now you've got to go get an Augmentin prescription at your local pharmacy. There are so many people in that experience that you have, because that's what it is. It's an experience. You're sick, but you're still, it's an experience with different digital touch points, different entities, different organizations, different companies to solve the same problem, which is to make you well. And when you think about that, it's like, hey, from the minute you make the request, that is logged. It is known who scheduled it. It's known when it was scheduled. It's known who you saw as the provider. Then it's known who gave that prescription, where that prescription was sent, who the pharmacy tech is that actually filled the prescription, who's the pharmacist that actually guided you on that prescription. The drug company itself had to provide all of the information associated with that prescription. And you know that your doctor was board certified in that state. You have all of these check boxes in place to make sure that your experience on your getting well doesn't make you worse, right? There are so many people that had to do that. Now, fast forward, that was 2020. Fast forward to 2024. A lot of those processes are going to or already are controlled by AI. The scheduling, the diagnostic, the filling of the pharmacist, the filling of the pharmacy, the creation and the printing of the label, all the way through to, say, Amazon's pharmacy, which is going to deliver those drugs to your house so you don't even have to leave it. Now, if AI is being used, I'm curious, can you give me all the names of the data scientists or machine learning models that built that? No, you can't. Why not? So if the model made a mistake or the model went wrong, even if the system responded correctly, but the model was wrong, I have one question to any company in that. At what point do you know who is going to go testify before Congress when there's a problem? And the speed and scale at which AI can solve problems, the counterpoint to that is the speed and scale at which AI can go wrong. And that's what we're trying to kind of guardrail against.
I can imagine that the ecosystem of data scientists would shift dramatically if suddenly you had to sign waivers or put your name. It's like, oh, if something happens with this, I'm criminally liable. It's a very different ecosystem to sort of grow up in. I'm not sure people would be as excited to be
data. And by the way, when you think about it, data scientists make hundreds of thousands of dollars in private industry, right? Yeah. I can tell you from experience, there are data scientists that make averages $600,000-$800,000 a year, and their models are touching millions of people a day. And here's how many things they've had to sign. Zero.
Yeah. It's almost like data science malpractice insurance is like...
Now, that pharmacy tech who's making $65,000 a year, they have to sign their name every prescription that goes out the door. Now, they're not sitting there physically signing it, but the system makes sure that they know who did what.
Digitally tracked, yes. Yeah.
It is digitally tracked. And so the things that we're trying to do is kind of create that so that it disappears into the background, because attestation and knowledge and insight is that is as valuable as having that bill of materials, and you have to have both.
We had another analogy that we had discussed in some of our earlier conversations is the basically evolution that the financial services industry has gone through, right? Mm-hmm. And the rigor that has now been built into a lot of the governance systems, the attestations, the assurances embedded in their model development and their governance systems. Do you see us borrowing from some of those frameworks and rigor for
this? I do. I think you look at like the Federal Reserve's SR 11-7 regulation, that's a really interesting one that you can go out and Google for those listening. That was in response to the Great Financial Crisis in 2008. And it was a 2011 rule, if you will, and regulation, which is interesting because when you read it, it talks about a bank's model risk. But what they're talking about there is financial model. They're really talking about what is the capital requirements that are necessary across the institution to make sure that you're solvent and you can resist shocks and whatnot. Again, that was done in 2011. Fast forward to 2021. In 2021, there's not a piece of capital in any of the major banks that doesn't touch or is not touched by a machine learning model or an artificial intelligence application at some point, right? And I'm making a very clear delineation there between a machine learning model and an AI app. But in this case, I'm talking specifically about the machine learning model. That ML model touches all kinds of capital and creates all kinds of reports, and people have to sign their name to it. Guess what? The banks and the capital markets players are making sure that the data scientists, the machine learning model, architects and engineers who are involved in that also are signing their name to that, at least from an internal compliance and control perspective, because as they meet those requirements, you can be darn sure that if it gets to a point where they need to go in front of Congress, that they're not saying, I don't know who that person is, Senator.
Yeah, I think what also struck me about this conversation and just kind of thinking through the myriad of interconnected systems, right, and decision tools throughout the organizations that we don't even think about, that just run society and industry today. Some of the more surprising kind of nodes of potential risk I thought were probably not necessarily obvious to our audience. I'd love to maybe Dee and Marcello have you guys talk about some of the more perhaps surprising threat nodes that you help organizations think about and manage within their systems. And specifically, we were talking about some of the data scientists and perhaps how social engineering might or behavioral engineering might.
Yeah, I think Marcello is probably really well equipped to talk about that. Hey, Marcello, one of the things you and I've talked about is we like to say our threat teams, they hunt data scientists, they hunt ML engineers. Yes. Maybe you can talk about that as at a high level as to why hunting them is so much fun.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot to dissect here. So first thing is that the human is always the weakest link, even when it comes to ML, AI infrastructure. Like, human is always going to be the weakest link. And the problem is, at least from the way I see things, is that data scientists, ML engineers don't have a strong security background. So what happens is when they stand up infrastructure, either internally on their organization, maybe they mistakenly put it on the internet. Maybe they mistakenly open it up to the entire network internally. Maybe they install it incorrectly, which can basically consequently introduce vulnerabilities into their organization. And what happens is that both me and Dan, my colleague, we found a number of vulnerabilities that specifically, if we were to specifically target data scientists and these engineering departments working on machine learning models, we'd be able to compromise the entire organization and the models, which is, from a capital perspective, the most important thing that they probably have, because they spent sometimes millions of dollars training these models, tuning them to deploy them into production. And definitely one thing that there's like three different attack surfaces here. There's also there's the human aspect of things, and the fact that there's no, for lack of a better term, cross-pollination between like the security teams and the machine learning teams. There's also the supply chain itself and the infrastructure underpinning LLMs and machine learning models that we found a number of vulnerabilities that allow you to directly access the servers hosting these software systems from an attacker perspective, which would be almost a gold mine. And there's obviously also the supply chain of things, where the open source libraries that are being utilized by the infrastructure of these AI and ML systems are also vulnerable as well. So there's like three different attack surfaces here going on at the same time. And if I had to convey something to the audience, would be that there's this huge focus in the industry towards LLMs specifically, just because of the hype cycle currently right now. But the more important thing to look at in my mind is the infrastructure underpinning those LLMs and machine learning models, from a security perspective at least. Because LLMs, like, up until this point, we only know about like 2 to 3 attacks that are possible using LLMs from an offensive cybersecurity perspective. Meanwhile, the infrastructure of underpinning those LLMs and those machine learning models have an enormous amount of attack surface. And we have 20 years of cybersecurity experience that documenting all of these kind of attacks. So there's a lot more to look at but there's a lot of things to dissect when it comes to the infrastructure itself.
If I am a business leader, right, in an organization and trying to wrap my arms around how to get started with safeguarding more of our technology and our operations, right, to take practical steps to safeguard our position, what are some very practical next steps that you typically coach leaders to begin to think about and undertake? Of course, call you guys. That's step number one. But how do you even, this is a massive potential threat landscape. So how do you even get started there?
So I think So we always start our customer conversations very simply, which is with two simple questions, but two very hard answers. One, how secure is our AI? How do you think about that? And then the second is, okay, how do we know? Right? Because It's that Mark Twain quote, something akin to, it's not what that gets you into trouble, it's what you absolutely don't know that you think that gets you into trouble, or something like that. I can't remember what the quote is, but I think what you'll find is that you have a real, you have kind of three categories of people who will answer the first question of how secure is our AI. It'll either be super secure, or it's going to be, we think it's secure, but we're not sure. Or people who say, I'm going to bury my head in the sand and pretend it's not a problem. It's the first one that's going to get you into trouble. Because what they're going to do is they're going to say, well, code is code, right? No, it's not. This system's the same as every other we built, right? No, it's not. Everything that we're doing in our code pipeline or our data pipeline, and hey, but we trusted vendor X and it's backed on cloud platform Y. So what? That means nothing. So I think that you have to start with those two questions, because what you'll quickly learn is that, like any other technology transition, you have to think about the tool, the processes that you need, the tools you're going to need, and the people you're going to need to train and to reskill and upskill. And I think people assume that the tools we already have are good enough. They're not. The processes we've built are sufficient. They're not. And hey, we hired this one AI ML expert and they say that they know everything. It's like, oh, cool. What happens when that person leaves for your competitor? Even if it's true, which it's not, but even if it's true, if you have this AI superhero and they leave, you're screwed. So you kind of need to think through those things. And what you'll quickly realize is that you don't have the ability to answer those questions. How secure is it? How do you know? And as a result, you don't know what tools you need, what processes you need, and how to upskill your people. And that's when you call Protect AI, or you go to protectai.com and book a demo. But there's the shameless plug. But I think that you can get started by thinking about how you would answer those two questions, because it'll tell you what you need to go do.
I really like that framing, Dee, particularly around sort of the what happens when that superhero leaves, because I think a lot of the machine learning or data science shops at a lot of companies have been pretty small, and now they're getting very excited and they're sort of questioning how much to staff up and how to sort of mitigate that risk. But it's sort of interesting to sort of pose this idea of, well, it's not like that person has to leave for your competitor, that person just might leave. And
yeah, right.
A lot of considerations around what they know, what risks they mitigated, how thoughtful that original person is, might mm-hmm. not carry over to the next person, that there's institutional memory loss, as well as just maybe skill degradation of, like, you just don't need to hire someone to build it because it's already built. So you hire someone to manage it who just doesn't quite know as much. So I guess I see a lot of sort of ecosystemic risks moving out into the future on the horizon here. Where do you see in this threat landscape sort of maybe emerging threats that aren't here today, but as the ecosystem matures in the space, that are probably going to be sort of the big hitter tomorrow in a decade or 20 years or so?
I personally think there's going to be a time where people are going to feel a lot more comfortable hooking up these AI systems to physical machines. And that's where things are going to get very interesting and potentially scary real fast, because there is benefits, absolute benefits, of hooking up these AI systems to maybe assembly lines or automating tasks that it would take humans a fair mental effort to do and physical effort to do. And that's where things from a cybersecurity perspective will get a little bit more intense. So that's why, like, when people ask me, like, what do you see, like, what's the main issue that you see right now with ML and AI? I say secure by design principles, because we have the opportunity now that this industry is nascent and new to actually take a step back, take a look at what we're doing, maybe detach ourselves from the hype cycle a little bit, and understand, like, what can we do now to ensure that 10, five, maybe even 5 years into the future, this isn't going to be like some of the biggest issues that we've seen in the cybersecurity space. So that's at least from my perspective.
Yeah, I would take that plus one on everything that my friend and colleague Marcello has said. But I would say, I think what becomes even more interesting is right now we're just thinking about LLMs, large language models. And so when you think about large language models, combined with more agency, i.e. more degrees of freedom on things like physical infrastructure or media creation, I think what becomes really interesting as both an opportunity and a threat space is when you go to large multimodal models or LMMs, when you start adding unstructured video, imagery, all kinds of things, both the opportunity and the holy cow threats. There's a Slack channel that I'm on right now that has an AI generated image of every tank that has been destroyed to date in the Ukraine-Russian conflict of Russia. It's an AI generated image and it's insane. And I'm thinking to myself, what happens when I can take an LMM, put it on a squadron of $100 drones and weaponize that? How do I defend against that? Those are some of the things that we are spending a lot of time thinking about. We're spending a lot of time talking to a variety of government partners about, and we want to support the mission across the United States government and others and our partners to give us both the advantages and edges, but also the defenses necessary in this space as it evolves.
Yeah, it's critical, and it's noble work. It's critical work. And we're all, this is an inevitable threat landscape and opportunity landscape that we're racing into. We spent a lot of time with our team and with our expert network, including yourselves, thinking through how we can design for ecosystemic resilience. And I think the work that you're doing is so essential and so strongly aligned to kind of that thinking. And we're deeply grateful for the work that you're doing, deep respect. And we hope
that pales in comparison, Diane, to all of the people that are working every day at NASA and beyond, and the federal agencies and the civilian agencies that back them up. So it's not just noble, but it's exciting, it's noble, it's critical, it's vital, and all the other truly non-hyperbole terms that we... So we're very thankful and honored to be here, and thank you for the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. To that point, Dean Marcello, final thoughts for our audience and for our team. What guidance would you offer us as we kind of wrap up the session here?
Marcello?
I would say that the most important thing right now that you can do if you're an organization is talk to your ML, data scientists, engineering teams, and make them talk to their security. Make them just have a talk to their security team. Just start training them. Just give them, maybe make them take a few secure coding classes. Make them have a few basic security classes as well, like maybe network security. But extremely important is to get those two sides of your organization to start talking and understanding each other much better, because that's the main thing that's probably going to help you in the long run.
And I would say, if you are out of the technical space, or you're a director or a leader or a manager, and you're not responsible for what we call fingers on keyboards, I would say, go ask your teams, do a workshop, do it over coffee, do it over napkins in a bar. Ask yourself these two questions. We know we have AI today there. The AI is not new. Let's be clear. You've got models in production right now. I know this. We have federal customers in a whole lot of spaces. There are models all over right now. And then you need to ask yourself the two questions plus one I'm going to give you. The two questions are, how secure is our AI ML? Second, how do we know? Have that discussion. And here's the third. What would our response be if something were to go wrong? What would be our incident response? Because we think you need to move from red teaming, and blue teaming, i.e. purple teaming, where the two learn from each other. We're applying a term called violet teaming, which is, when you think about the difference of AI, AI enables non-technical people to be impacted by technical things, and they need to respond. So who else would you bring to that so that you have a violet teaming perspective?
Love that. Love that. We're taking that back to our team for sure. The Dean Marcello, James, thank you. What an amazing conversation. And we've given our audience a lot to think about. And certainly we're going to have them plug into your digital exhaust, follow your work, and see if we can all get to a better future together. Violet team the future together.
You got it.
Thanks, everyone. Really appreciate it. And everyone, as plug into this podcast series in your favorite podcast channels, or you can always check out socialmorks.com. Please stay tuned and keep in touch. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks again, everyone, for joining us today. And please do check out this season's new episodes to join our discovery journey as we explore the AI arena, pressure testing hype versus reality, and understanding where practical applications of these capabilities are shaping ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts for your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can always learn more at socialmorks.com.